Hey, Slingers, welcome back to another week of the Word Slinger podcast. And I'm talking to GP James today. You're going to want to hear this interview. So stick around. We'll get to it next.
It's the Word Slinger podcast, where story matters. Build your brand, write your book, redefine who you are. It's all about the story here. What's yours now? Here's the guy who invented pants optional, Kevin Tomlinson, the Word Slinger.
Word Slinger.
Well, I am Kevin Tomlinson, the Word Slinger. I am really glad you're here. Welcome, by the way, to another Word Slinger podcast interview Friday. I'm struggling to name these things since I've split the format. Another change, by the way, that I have made as of really this week was to I think I've fully decided I'm going to just go back to doing audio only for the podcast for a few reasons. People weren't really responding well to the video. And it's not that they weren't responding well. I wasn't getting a lot of, you know, subscribers, and I wasn't really, it's an extra bit of work that, wasn't really paying off. Maybe it would long term, and maybe I'll bring it back again, and maybe next week I'll be announcing how I've changed and I'm doing video again. Who knows? But for right now, I've decided that it's just a little easier just to do the audio version. Let me know what you think of that. I know I ask you guys this stuff all the time, but you know, I value your input. So anyway, all that said, I mean, I'm sure lots is going to happen. A lot of stuff's going to happen. And I still have the video interviews. I still record them as video. I do intend to use that. So it's not going to be wasted. I just want to sort of pull back and recenter a little, because I like the audio version. I like what I do here. And I'm having a good time with it. And, you know, that's what it's all about. So, anyway, things change. And I got a lot more of you guys listening than I do watching. Something to the tune of about 40 to 50,000 people download and listen to the show each week, while a scant like 200 people were watching it on YouTube. Now, I don't know. They may have been watching it somehow, some way elsewhere. Maybe when you watch it on my show notes page, it's different. I'm not sure, but let me know what you think. If this is disappointing to you, I apologize. I'm going to get it all worked out. I'm going to figure it all out. So today I'm talking to GP James, and this guy is just, he's got his fingers in everything. He lives in LA. He's a writer, a music creator. He's, you know, worked with some folks in the film industry. We're going to be talking about his book Meltdown, which published May 15th, so we're almost a month out from it being out there, but definitely want to push that. I want you to check that out. Go to the show notes and you'll find links to his website, to his book. You can follow him on Twitter. A lot of cool stuff there, so check that out. But let's just hear from the man himself. Let's hop on over to this interview with GP James, and I'll see you on the other side. Hey, everybody. Thank you for tuning in to another great Word Slinger podcast interview. Now, today's guest is GP James. He's the author of Meltdown. We're going to call him Greg, just so it's a little easier on me throughout the show. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Thanks for having me.
I'm going to reemphasize, GP James is the author's name you're going to want to look for when you hear about this book. So we'll put that out there. It'll be in the show notes and everything, name of the episode and all that. But just so that we're nice and friendly, man. So welcome to the show. Because of the speed with which all this was set up, I have not yet had a chance to read your book. I did kind of thumb through and take a look, though. And I'm very fascinated because this is, you know, I'm a thriller writer and cool. Big fan of this genre. And this is how would you classify this book, by the way?
How would I classify it? It's an environmental thriller, I guess to say.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, I could ride with that. Why don't you give me a little bit of the premise and we'll roll from there.
Sure. Yeah. So it takes place in Peekskill, New York, 35 miles outside of the center of Manhattan. And what happens is there's an earthquake, mm-hmm. unexpected earthquake, of course, being on the East Coast, and this nuclear power plant that's on the edge of the Hudson River just goes into disarray, loses power, systems are shutting down. And when that happens, they can't cool the reactor. And if you can't cool the reactor, you could end up in a meltdown scenario.
Yeah.
So my protagonist, my lead is character is inside the plant. He's one of the plant managers, and he's trying to stabilize the reactor. And then his wife is on the outside looking for their daughter who's been lost in the disaster wreckage.
It has all the earmarks of a Hollywood blockbuster, man.
Pretty much.
yeah, so, you know, and this is the kind of thing, by the way. Now, how much of the story is completely factual in terms of location and that sort of thing?
All of it.
All of it. These locations exist, yeah.
Yeah, the power plant is real. I've changed the name, of course, because I'm not looking to... you know,
create them chaos and
yeah, and it's not really about them.
Yeah,
and, you know, it's about the wide awareness. But I felt like that was a good place to stage this, given the, you know, the unknown fault line there, the proximity right. plant to the fault line.
Right, right. Yeah, I mean, you know, it's a topic that's very interesting to me because, it's almost a man versus nature kind of story. Almost. It's like man versus past man who wasn't really thinking about it. You know, who puts a nuclear plant on a fault line kind of thing. But it's fascinating to me because, you know, I've been exposed to, well, maybe I should rephrase this. I haven't been exposed to radiation or anything, but I've seen plenty of these plants that are in places I'm like, wow, one well-placed natural disaster and the whole, you know, ecosystem goes belly up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what happened in Fukushima.
Exactly right, yeah.
And there is another power plant out here and near Los Angeles. It's called the San Onofre. It's more towards San Diego. But they closed that after Fukushima. And this thing is right on the beach. Like, it's crawling into the ocean on the sand. And
right.
I'm glad they closed it, you know. Yeah. Thank you. You know, but yeah, you know. Who's not thinking about that when you build something like this, that, oh, maybe a tsunami could come and just wipe out the whole
thing? The thing is, though, you know, how do you think ahead on something? Like in your story, there's an earthquake in a region that just does not get earthquakes.
Right.
So how do you think ahead on a scenario like that when traditionally, and I think the answer is that, you know, you just have to prepare for the worst no matter what. Like,
right.
you know, there could be. What if there were an explosion that was enough to create an earthquake on that
fault? Really? Yeah. You built this thing 35 miles outside of one of the largest cities in
Mexico. Possibly the most densely populated city on the planet. Yeah, you
have 20 million people within 50 miles.
Right.
It's interesting.
Yes. Yeah. No, and that's what makes – it not only makes for a great story – there is a sort of message there, not a sort of message, there's literally a message there, that perhaps we should rethink, the positioning. So people tend to think of, nuclear power. I do as well. I think of it as very safe in general. But it's safe in the way that an airplane is safe. As long as everything is going okay, you're safe. When something goes wrong, it's not safe.
That's safe. Not good. That's right. Like anything in life, right? But yeah. Some have different thresholds of safety, I'd say, or
right.
you have different levels of impact if something goes wrong, I guess.
Right, right,
yeah.
Right. So what did you do for research for this?
Lots. tons, years of it, and it was interesting and kind of maddening at times to try to cram to wrap a story around the research and have it flow, and it was kind of challenging in that way. But read lots of books about nuclear power, about past disasters, about Fukushima, about Three Mile Island, about Chernobyl.
Yeah.
Books on how nuclear power plants function, endless research online, I had a few advisors in nuclear power that helped me. Dave Lockbaum from the Union of Concerned Scientists read the book and fact checked everything for me, and very grateful for that. And I was pretty much spot on. He gave me a few things that I changed, but did a lot of research. It was good.
Yeah, that's the way you want to do it. I mean, you've got, because you're not writing a history paper here or anything, right. But you're crafting a story that does rely on existing science, existing, you know, theory, and problems that we could come up with. So what was it that drove you to want to write this story in particular, though?
Well, this was a spinoff of a first novel that I wrote that had the impetus of that novel was a nuclear power plant meltdown. It was just sort of a thread in that story that was about an advanced energy technology called Zero Point Energy. And my editor suggested that I just write a book just about a nuclear power plant meltdown. He thought that was much more compelling. He felt that it had never been done before, even though, you know, we're writing in this sort of cliche format, if you will, thriller format, Hollywood format, sure. But no one had done a story like that. And so I thought about it, and I decided to take it in that direction and create this second book off of that. And I was passionate about all this from the beginning, from Fukushima, from this earthquake that happened in 2011 around the same time in Virginia.
Right.
You know, and I felt like, wow, this could happen here. We have these other energy technologies that are not being used, typically because of financial reasons or for reasons of control. And I felt like it was an important story to tell.
Yeah. Yeah. And you brought up Zero Point Energy, which is something I'm very interested in and have looked at, as a component of story more than anything. That's fascinating. I don't want to get off on that tangent because we'll geek out.
I could go down the rabbit hole. I did a lot of research on that.
We'll have to do a whole separate episode.
Oh, I'd love that.
So you are, now according to your bio, you're a writer and a music creator living in LA. So how do you balance those two fields?
Well, I've been writing up until this year every day, at least on average of 4 hours, I'd say. And I would write in the morning. So 5, 6 a.m. I'd start, and music would happen later. And that's been my career, music and sound mixing, for albums, TV shows, and films. So that was sort of how I balanced it. They sort of happen at different parts of the day, and you could kind of only write so much in a day and have any quality to it.
Yeah, I agree with that. Yeah.
You know, it comes out and it's like, well, that's all I got, you know?
Yeah. Yeah,
and then you do it the next day, and it's like it's climbing a mountain.
But I do, I like, so you remind me of a good friend of mine who's an author and also a composer. And he's scoring his books and other people's books now. He's actually creating score. You could do the same thing.
That's amazing.
but that secondary creative outlet is his release from the tension and stress of the writing business.
Sure.
So.
Yeah, they're different ways of creating. They intertwine. I feel like all creativity intertwines. I even like paint stuff. I draw stuff too. I write poetry. So it all connects in some way. That creative process, that creative channel. But then there's the differences of how they flow. And definitely the music has a much more easeful flow in end to end process. There's not. Yeah. Much like painstaking editing that's happening.
So do you listen to music while you're actually writing?
Oh yeah.
You have a soundtrack? Is it your music or is it
not my music. I listen to a lot of cinematic stuff. I'll listen to like Hans Zimmer, stuff like that. I listen to binaural tones, if you're familiar with that. Just you know, for brainwave states, keep you really focused. Fela Kuti. I don't know if you're familiar.
But no.
An incredible artist from Africa. He was alive in the 60s, 70s. Incredible. But his music is very, the songs are very long. They're very like hypnotic, sort of entrancing. and all kinds of incredible. It's like kind of like funk, acid, jazz kind of stuff. It's really
okay. Cool.
So he played a lot while I was.
Yeah.
And I would listen to different types of music to give me a vibe for what I was, the scene I was writing.
Right. Yeah.
I'm sure you did the same.
No, I do. Yeah. I have, I just pull up cinematic, soundtracks and just let them run in the background. And I used to try to tailor the mix so that as I'm writing it, I know this scene's going to be a romantic scene. So I want to bring in some romantic music. This scene's going to be a punch of drama and this scene's going to be action. And I would try to sort of customize as I went, but it was just too stressful. I just decided whatever the fates hand me.
Sure.
Yeah. So you're okay. Now you live in LA, but you're writing about an area near Manhattan. Had you visited this area? Do you know much about it personally?
I grew up over there. So I grew up.
Okay.
Yeah. And I grew up in New Jersey, spent a lot of time in New York. My family's back there. So very, very familiar with the area.
What took you out to LA? You were pursuing the dream.
Right? Now I'm living the dream.
Now you're living the dream. That's what I like to hear, man. I can tell, by the way, I almost could tell instantly that you're one of these multi-creative, driven, but also kind of laid back, in your own way, but still driven. I like how you when I asked for your topic, I like how you described the book as the pace of the Bourne Identity, the technical depth of Michael Crichton, and the universal magnitude of Dan Brown. You've set yourself up at epic proportions there, my friend.
Hey, marketing. I see every day. They're like, it's like this, and then you watch it or read it, and you're like, no.
Yeah. Yeah, yeah. Do you feel that your book hits those expectations?
I do.
Okay.
I do.
I would not expect any less from you. I'm just
in a certain respect. My editor, Dick Merrick, he did 14 Robert Ludlum books. He edited. Yeah.
Okay.
He did the Bourne trilogy. He published and edited them. I feel like the pacing is there. It's not the same story, of course. I got a couple of one or two reviews are like, oh, it's not like that at all. I was like, okay, yeah, it's not that story, but there's a pacing there. My technical depth is definitely on point, Sure, why not the universal magnitude?
People get hung up on the weirdest things, man. I mean, I have the group of readers who say, it's like a Dan Brown book. It's like Indiana Jones. And then people read that and they get really upset that my guy isn't running around with a bullwhip and a.
Right.
Or a,
it's
just
a vibe, It's the genre. It's a thing.
Exactly. That needs to be its own BISAC category, Dan Brown-esque.
Esque. That's
what I did, but esque. The esque category. Esque. We're going to get this done, man. We're going to pull this off. So this is not your first book. How many books do you have out right now?
Well, this is the first one that's published.
Oh, okay, okay.
Yeah, this is the first published. I have the first novel I've written. Needs a little work. I have halfway through a third novel. Then coming out probably before any other novels will be a few poetry books, which are done. Designer's almost done, so I'm waiting. And I have also have a book of essays I wrote. I wrote a lot of existential poetry. Total departure from the thriller novel. I kind of go into the literary world deep and get deep into the existential stuff, into the big into the mystical and esoteric topics.
So, yeah. I was looking at the covers of the other two books. I guess I missed the coming soon in bold letters directly beneath them, but they have a almost Eastern vibe. Artwork wise.
They do, yeah, and I'm steeped in those practices for many years, the meditation, yoga practicer, and into all that.
Quite a spectrum you've developed for yourself.
splattered.
It's not though. It's really not though. When you consider that you've written an eco thriller, environmental thriller, right. You're exploring the same themes with different tones.
Yeah,
I would expect deliveries. No less. Yeah, I would expect no less from somebody who creates music.
Thank you.
Look, the marketing message just writes itself, man.
I love it. Hey, Scott, yeah. You know, we're knocking on the doors to see where we, which one's open, see where we fit in.
Exactly right. So you're, you know, and poetry is such a difficult market. Have you got a publisher for the poetry, or are you self-publishing, or what are you doing there?
I don't have a publisher yet. I have someone in mind. Andrews McNeil, I think.
Okay.
If you're listening, I'm coming for you.
I'm so sure everyone there is such a big listener of the
words. Yeah, they're listening. I'm sure they're tapping right now. But they publish a couple very popular poetry books right now, sold millions of copies, and I think some of it is good. Mm-hmm. And I think my stuff is really good and would be interesting. So I'm gonna make some approaches, and I actually may do a Kickstarter on the one book, because it's very special. I want it hardcover cloth. I might do a leather bound version.
Yeah.
Gilded edges, because it kind of has that sort of like, you know, antique look to it, ancient look.
Yeah,
to it.
Yeah, make it feel, yeah, yeah. I understand what you're doing.
Out with that and try to do something artsy with it.
You know? If the people who support you on Kickstarter get along with the book a free Ziploc baggie filled with dust to dust.
Magic the dust.
Yeah, yeah, there you go.
I might send a crystal.
Are you now, are you working on any more thrillers though? Or are you, is this just
yeah, a third one. I'm halfway through.
Oh, you did say that. Yeah, I'm sorry.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah. So, yeah. So here's what you do, man. You have one of the characters, a prominent character, reading your poetry in the book. I like that. There you go. Like you tie them all together.
I like that.
Yeah.
Like this G.P. James poetry is incredible.
Now, are you writing that? Now, are you writing everything under G.P. James?
So far. Mm-hmm. So far, it's a weird pen name, it's a weird space, but my last name is Papania, and okay. Like, you know, a lot of people can't grasp that, and when it's like, what's your name, like GP James, can't mess that up,
right?
You mess
right.
That up, I'm sorry, you know.
Yeah,
but
give Papania, me
time. It's like, I'm not, how do you spell, what was his name, I don't know.
Look, I'm writing under Tomlinson. I hear you.
And it's also like, when it's your own, you look at it differently. Like I look at your name and I'm like, oh, that's fine, I get that, but then again, I'm not everyone else. I can grasp whatever name, but
I get Tomlinson a lot. A lot of reviewers, a lot of people reviewing will write Tomlinson. So it is problematic, but you know, I don't know, I haven't done a test. I don't know if maybe if
K-Tom.
Yeah, I actually just interviewed thriller writer Jack Carr, who was telling me that Lee Child gave him the advice of, because Jack Carr is his pseudonym, his pen name. He gave him the advice of picking a name that comes pretty early on in the alphabet to milk that advantage. So now I'm thinking, you know, the gears are turning. You know, I'm going to be an Anderson or an, you know.
I agree with you. It's so funny. It's so funny.
I can't rebrand now though. I mean, it's just too much. Just, you know, 30 years of writing behind me. Ooh, I can't.
Wow.
Can't rebrand now.
Right. That's a lot. I guess I put my stake in the ground early now.
I'm there you go.
James, and that's it.
That worked, man. It worked for EL James. Why not?
Hey.
There you go. I don't think that anybody's going to make the mistake of picking up one of your books thinking it's E.L. James. So unless you put maybe some handcuffs or something on the cover.
An idea.
You could do it. Maybe. The poetry, man.
You're onto something here.
Poetry that frees us from bondage. And now you've got a market. So now you say you did a lot of research. By the way, the research part is always – that's threatening to me, because what I'll end up doing is researching to the point where I don't actually write the book, because I'm so, you know, mired in the research. Like, how did you manage all of it while you were doing that?
It was just a dance, you know. It was a balance of getting enough to start, starting, making notes for what I need. And then going back, looking that up, going back. And so it was really a back and forth process. But it, I don't know that I would do it again like that with something that you have to be so technically detailed for, because I want it to be real. I can't have a nuclear person read this and say, oh, that doesn't function like that.
Right.
Oh, right. That doesn't. No, we can't have that happen. So
this is why I always pay attention when Homer Simpson goes to work. If I ever want to write about nuclear facilities, That's my go-to source.
Totally. And that's pretty much, I just watched all the episodes of The Simpsons. And that's how I learned how to do this. And it worked out.
That's how I learned to do half of what I do in life, man. That's cool, man. Yeah. Was part of your intention to write it, though, with a message in mind to influence people when it came to nuclear energy?
Of course. Yeah. Definitely. Anything I do has to have a socially conscious thread. The purpose is to spread awareness, share information that many people may not know about, and try to, you know, elevate the consciousness.
Yeah.
I think that's important. I think most of us write or create with that in mind. Some of us may
even
just...
Even if we're not cognizant of it.
Right. Yeah. And even a subconscious thing. And even if you're not cognizant, even the people that just, you think they're creating for purely entertainment and maybe they are, and those are the ones that don't realize, oh, there are messages in there.
Yeah. 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 I, ironically, just before this call, I was reading, James Scott Bell's, one of his books in which he, you know, he calls out this very point. And basically, I forget who he quoted, but it was, you know, if you want to send a message, try Western Union. But I actually think that
my editor said that to me.
Okay, there you go.
In a letter. But
here's what I believe, and I truly believe this, that it's kind of along the lines of the message is the medium, right? You know, you're telling a story, you're crafting entertainment, not necessarily, you know, you're crafting a good story. So it works on that level. As long as it works on that level, everything else you put into it is fine.
I agree.
It has to work on that level, or otherwise it's no good.
Of course.
Yeah.
Of course. That's funny. Yeah, I got that line dropped on me in a letter that was tearing
the
message anyway. Shut up.
Everyone in the publishing industry reads like the same five books, man. The same five books on leadership.
So, right. And they read the same five books and genres too.
They do, yeah. Which is why, you know, I sometimes wonder, and maybe, and I'd be curious, because you've done something to me which is slightly off the trail, as it were, for most thriller writers, like, you know, because you're into so many other things that are not strictly. Most of the thriller writers I talk to, if I interview them on the show, they've got some background, like they were in the military, they were an environmental scientist, they were, you know, a lawyer. And you're coming at this from a very different, more creative, not more creative. I don't want to start that rumor. Sure. You're coming to this as someone who works in a creative industry that has nothing to do with the topic of your book.
Sure.
Which is an appealing idea to me, by the way.
Sure.
Do you feel like that helped you in crafting this story, even sort of coming at it as an outsider?
It definitely, sure. Well, you know, I think you create differently when you're more of an artist type, and maybe less of the sort of, like, you know, left brain person who, you know, has a creative side or that creative outlet.
Right.
And I don't know if it helped me necessarily, but it's like, I feel like everything I do as a creative person is supposed to have a message. So to me, it's like whatever is coming through that I feel, you know, people's awareness should be tuned to, and maybe there are others supporting that, but maybe it's not amplified enough, in my opinion. So how can I amplify this more, and what can I do creatively behind it to spread that awareness?
Yeah. Yeah. And I think that's the right approach. You know, we come at this, we're artists. The thing about being an author these days,
we're balancing two lives essentially, because there is the art, there's the business of writing. Sorry about that, everybody. You heard the vibration of my mic. There's the business side of it, and we, in my circles at least, there tends to be an overemphasis of the business side. There is then the craft side or the art side of it that, you know, is equally important. And if you can get those two working in harmony, it's like if you got both hemispheres of your brain working in harmony, you know, who knows what you could accomplish. Sure. So I like the approach, man.
Yeah, it's, thank you. And it's a challenge, as you know, to balance those two sides. And we're all still learning. I mean, I'm just first book, you know, going out into publishing, and every day I'm learning how people are, you know, getting through the market and this and that. And again, you have to put that other hat on, but you know, the creative in me and probably in you and others just wants to like go in the room and create stuff and write and just let other people do all the other business stuff. You know, it's yeah. When I finished a book, it was like, oh, it's done. All right, we're going to sell it. And I was like, okay, you know, a year later,
yeah,
it went, you know. And
so what was that process about? Did you get a, I hadn't even really put this together and haven't looked, but you traditionally published or indie published?
Traditionally published by Wyatt McKenzie, which is like a mid-level out of Oregon.
Okay.
And nice people. And they reached out to me, and they were very passionate about the story. So I went with it. The book, it did circulate around the big five, big four, whatever it is, you know,
went to
Random House, Penguin, this one, that one, went to all high level agents, and no one grabbed onto it. But this is good.
Yeah. No, yeah, I agree. I'm just curious what the process was like.
Yeah, it was interesting. You know, everyone's got, the thing about it is who knows? It's like I felt like when I was sending around, I was like, oh, well, maybe it's a cliche story format. It kind of is, yeah, but I wrote it like that because I was trying to convey this message. Oh, well, they're not, you know, you go with this stuff. Oh, I guess they're not really feeling it. Oh, I should have wrote one of my literary novels. But, you know, you don't know. Then I know, I got friends who wrote, you know, really cool literary stuff that circulated. Oh, they had a high level agent, deal fell apart. This one, oh, that one had, everyone's got an opinion. So it's really, it's just throwing darts.
Yeah.
And you don't know everyone. I like the character. I don't like the character. Oh, the story is amazing. Oh, the pace was amazing. I thought the pace was a little slow. This is the responses I got. And when you saw that everyone was contradicting, you had to go, well, This is
what it is. I tell you what, if you give me money, then I'll let you influence the shape of the story. That's
what I said. Do it. I'm going to rewrite another word.
Right.
My editor was happy with it, and he's tough. If he was happy, he either got tired of me or he was happy.
Yeah.
He was enough for me.
No. And that makes sense to me. Like you get the stories, you're going to farm a book around for months, years, decades. You know, I don't know when we decide enough is enough on a book. Honestly, because I indie publish now, cause I had the whole traditional thing briefly and decided I liked the control or whatever, but now I'm back out there kind of, you know, I'm talking to agents who are interested in some of the work. They're interested in the fact that I have a platform. They're interested in, so that's all very cool. So now, but that it shifts my experience of that industry. So I'm always looking to find out like, how do people normally get there? And no, there's no one path, man.
No one path. I've been talking to some film companies, you know, and some of that's happened through me sending my novel in. Some of it's been like a friend has called, you know, I know a lot of folks in different industries out here and been like, hey, my friend works at, you know, this studio and he produced blah, blah, blah. I'm like, okay. And then you get a meeting and, you know, sometimes it knocks on your door. It's quite fascinating. But the indie route is interesting to me just going through this process. And I have other friends who have big publishing deals, And they didn't, the publisher didn't really do anything for them. They still had to hire a publicist. They still had to do all this work. They still had to put out money, and that's fine. So looking at there's positive threads to the different avenues of putting your work out.
Yeah.
And advertising, of course, is something recently I've been looking, online. I've been looking at these guys on Amazon, guys and girls that have had sold millions of copies through Kindle. And I'm looking like, okay, what do they do? What are they doing? And mm-hmm. I realized a lot of social media advertising.
Right.
One guy said he was spending $300 a day.
Yeah. That's, I know guys spending a lot more than that per day.
Wow. That's, wow.
And they're, but they're also, these guys are also buying, they're private, custom built catamarans in Hugh Howey's case, things like that. I mean, they're out.
Financial means to support
it. Right.
And that's what I realized. The one guy, he had some internet startup. And, he made millions, I'm sure. And the other guy, I don't know what his financial situation was. But, and then they were making a return on that investment, it seemed. That they were making, hundreds of thousands from that. And they got themselves up in the ranks. Now, I've read some of those books, and I can't say they're that good. But, okay. I respect.
They don't have to be. Yeah. That's
I respect their promotioning, promotional hustle.
Right. There's a need. There's a reader for every book. The key really is knowing how to reach those readers. So, So that's cool, man. Well, you've had an interesting journey. And the book sounds fascinating. I can't wait to dive in fully. This is the only downside to this gig, by the way, doing the Wordslinger podcast. The only downside is that a lot of these interviews come so fast. I don't get a chance to read the books, before I start. And I've got a read pile. I might as well just, if I filled these shelves behind me with my to be read pile, they'd be twice as full.
I'm sure, easily.
So, all right, man. Well, look, we're at time. I don't want to take up much more of your time. So I'm going to go ahead and wrap this up. Tell people where they can find you and your books online.
Sure. So at my website, gpjames.com, on Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, as GP James, and book is for sale in paperback and Kindle format on Amazon, and also for sale on Barnes & Noble.
Excellent. All right. Well, I appreciate you taking the time to chat with me, Greg, and everyone else listening out there. Right about now, you're probably hearing the groovy theme music. You may dance in place at will. If you'll stick around, you'll hear some industry news that you're really going to want to tune in for. And other than that, we're going to just hop on over. Thanks again, Greg, man. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right, everybody. See you on the other side.
And, well, this is That Other Side. I hope hope you enjoyed that interview with GP James. There is no industry news. I don't do that segment anymore. Yeah, that lets you know how long ago this was recorded. Well, I guess there's a little industry news I could share with you. Like things like there has been a bid to buy out Barnes & Noble. If you're interested in that, you can. Probably not going to bother putting a link in the show notes. I may. I think the implications of that are going to be kind of interesting. The fund or the group looking to buy it also bought out Waterstone in the UK. And their stated purpose for buying that property was that they were after the loyal users. They wanted to be able to reach the huge number of readers that those guys have. So the company or the investment firm or whatever it is, the Vulture Fund, really is looking at this as an opportunity to dip into the Barnes & Noble following. So what will that mean for indie publishers in particular? No idea. But it is something that's come up. It's interesting. Got some changes kind of coming. I guess I am doing a news segment. Look at that. I got some changes coming for Apple. Now, I've had questions. People have asked me, like, with Apple ditching iTunes, with them shutting down iTunes, is that going to impact anything? And the answer is no, because they pulled the books from iTunes quite a while back. It might impact audiobooks in some way. But it looks like Apple's really been working to integrate audiobooks into their Books app, among other little changes. So I don't think this is really going to impact anything on the book side. It's definitely not on the draft to digital side, so feel free to check it out. Beyond that, I don't have any other industry news. I haven't looked anything up, but I kind of like that segment. Maybe I should bring that back. It was always kind of a job of work on the video side, because it wasn't just finding the stories and reporting them. It was having to put up some kind of graphics and things, and just led to more work, and that's why I stopped doing it. So now I've got a new opportunity. Look at that. Change brings new opportunities. That's why you should embrace change. I know it's hard on all of us, but you can actually find new opportunities every time you encounter change in the world. Change and failure are the greatest tools for creating new resources in our arsenals. So anyway, man, that means, you know what? I just got this excited little buzz. I think some big things are coming. I think we're going to see some big things coming in the next few months from the Wordslinger podcast. So, all right. That is going to be it. I'm going to go ahead and wrap us up at 41 minutes, I might add. So that's a nice length for an episode. Hope you're taking care of yourselves out there. We've had some really interesting weather. And so we've had some here. Man, it's been a lot of flooding and stuff here in the Houston area, Sugarland, Texas, where I call home. But I hope you're taking care of yourselves. I know there's still snow and stuff happening. It's like there's snow, like in Arizona or something. It's weird. Whatever. I call magic. Voodoo of some sort. But take care of yourselves out there. Hope you have a wonderful weekend ahead. Hope you're enjoying the changes that are coming out of the Wordslinger podcast. Reach out to me. And some of you have, and I really appreciate it. You guys are being very supportive about all this with some great advice. I don't know if... I don't know if some of you are saying... maybe I have a face for radio. I don't know. You let me know. anyway, God bless each of you. And take care of yourselves. And I'll see you all next time. Wordslinger.